Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, featured on the ERS Respiratory Channel. My name is Alan Maurice. I'm currently Foundation Chair, Professor and Head of Respiratory Research Group at Hull York Medical School in the UK. I'm also Honorary Consultant Physician at Hull and East Yorkshire Hospitals NHS Trust. I've pioneered the investigation into the epidemiology, diagnosis and therapeutics of cough. This work has resulted in the production of national and international guidelines. This is ongoing in my role as chair of the ERS Guidelines Task Force. I'm very pleased to lead today's discussion on the topic of new chronic cough therapies. Joining me in this discussion are Jackie Smith and Laurent Guillemont. Jackie is a professor of respiratory medicine at the University of Manchester in the UK. And she is an honorary consultant at Manchester University NHS Foundation Trust. She runs a multidisciplinary research team whose focus is on understanding mechanisms underlying pathological cough and a regional clinical service seeing patients with a refractory chronic cough. Laurent is a professor of medicine in the Department of Respiratory Medicine and Allergic Disease at Toulouse University Hospital Center. He is a pulmonologist by training and runs a cough clinic in Toulouse, France. His main research interests are chronic cough and severe asthma.
We're a strange bunch because we're cough addicts. We like this condition cough, and to us it's really quite exciting because over the years our knowledge has increased and we've actually come to know cough so much better. There's been discoveries in terms of pathophysiology, discoveries in terms of therapy. I think it's a very exciting time to be in cough. So why are we so keen on this? Jackie, why do we think that cough is a unique thing rather than, oh, just a bit of asthma or whatever?
For a long time, I think all of us have been seeing patients with chronic cough, been treating reflux when they've got it, been treating asthma when they've got it, and nasal disease. And I think we all appreciate that while some patients might get better with those treatments, we see increasingly patients who either don't have any of those conditions, so the cough is really unexplained, or it's completely refractory to treatment of those underlying conditions, which makes us think there's something else going on that's driving the cough. And I think increasingly we all believe, and I think there's a lot of evidence now, that sensitization and hyperexcitability of the pathways that control the cough reflex is the real problem in cough that we have tended to call refractory or unexplained.
There's also a unique demographic, isn't there?
So by far the typical patient is female and usually between 50 and 70 years of age. And they give this really typical history that fits with this concept that their cough reflex is hyperactive. So they'll frequently tell you that most trivial of exposures to irritants, so cigarette smoke, strong perfumes and aftershaves, cleaning products, will trigger off horrendous episodes of coughing. They also tend to be sensitive to changes in temperature as well. And sometimes they get bad episodes of coughing and nothing's triggered it at all, so for no good reason. So in my mind, that all fits with this concept that the neuronal pathways are overactive.
So Laurent, do you in the clinic pick the patient with having chronic cough, or do you try and diagnose other things?
Yeah, the patient history is very important. And with the patient history, we can make a diagnosis. And sometimes we find cause of chronic cough, but most of the time we do not find any causes. And with the history, as Jackie said, we can find the triggers of chronic cough. When we have many triggers, it's a big argument for cough hypersensitivity syndrome. And with the history, we can say that, okay, I know your cough. I know you have a cough hypersensitivity syndrome, and limit the test, because the risk of chronic cough is doing many tests and at the end, no disease. So I think the history is enough for the diagnosis of chronic cough, and chronic cough is the diagnosis. It's important for our colleagues that now they should say to the patient, oh, I know your disease, you have chronic cough.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you'll get referral letters, won't you, where they've had CT scans and methacholine challenge, and nobody has recognized that there is this phenotype of disease, chronic cough. And to limit the investigations is one thing, but also you're able to predict things, and it's a great reassurance to the patient. So it's a distinct clinical syndrome. And if you're able to say to the patient, I'll bet you do this, or I'll bet you cough when you get out of bed in the morning, and they'll say, yes, you're absolutely right. And that's a very typical time. Jackie's done numerous cough recordings of patients, and they do get the coughing attack as they get out of bed, don't they, Jackie?
They absolutely do. It's one of the worst times, first thing in the morning.
So how, Laurent, would you actually diagnose someone in the clinic? Suppose I'm a woman and I'm a typical chronic cough patient because I'm a bit overweight and I'm middle-aged, should we say, late middle-aged.
I like the American guidelines because they give a piece of advice and we should exclude common disease that trigger cough, like asthma. So we don't need fancy investigations, just history and GERD, asthma, rhinosinusitis.
And a chest x-ray, yeah?
Yeah.
So what about a CT scan? Because I know you've done a bit of work on this recently.
Yes, it's hard to answer because there is a rare disease. Its name is deep neck, and it affects women after 50. And it's hard to exclude this disease just with the history. So in a woman with chronic cough for 10, 20 years, after 50, I would perform a CT scan in this particular patient. But we conducted a retrospective study on 600 patients, and we saw that in patients under 40 with dry cough, a CT scan is not helpful in chronic cough. So I think in those patients, we shouldn't perform CT scan. But in patients older than 40, and particularly in women, we should perform CT scan, and we should focus on nodules, on air trapping, because it's very important to diagnose deep neck. It's a rare disease.
But it is extremely rare, because there was some correspondence flying around about it a couple of weeks ago, wasn't there? You know, I looked it up a bit. It's a histological diagnosis with these the neuroendocrine cells, are they?
Yeah, exactly.
It's as rare as rocking horse manure, and it seems to occur out of the cough as well as with the cough. So rarities, yes, I quite agree with you, and things out of the ordinary. But if you're an ordinary chronic cough patient, then I would want to look towards treatment. So Jackie, come on, tell us about these treatments, because it revolves around the hypersensitivity bit.
It does.
How do we know that the patient's hypersensitive?
So there's lots of evidence out there, actually, that our patients are hypersensitive. So people have been doing cough challenges, including yourself, Alan, for many years now. And what's interesting, I think, about chronic cough patients is you can get them to inhale irritants, and capsaicin is one of the commonest, but people look at citric acid. We've done studies with PGE2. They look at fog. It doesn't seem to really matter what sort of irritant challenge you use. You can show that patients with chronic cough have exaggerated responses. So they'll tend to start coughing at lower concentrations than healthy controls. And they will tend to cough more as well to any particular stimulus. So in my mind, that's pretty good evidence of hypersensitivity. And perhaps most relevant to some of the more recent drugs, you've done some studies looking at cough responses to things like ATP, and they cough excessively to that as well.
Yeah, the ATP story is very interesting. And the new kid on the block, the blockers of ATP, P2X3 antagonists they're called, mm-hmm. They're proving really quite interesting in clinical trials, aren't they?
Absolutely. So as you know, we did the first study. And
indeed.
And like yourselves, have been doing studies with cough patients, trying different new therapies, mainly targeted at neuronal mechanisms for a long time, and, you know, been hopeful that we'd find something. But that study was the very first one where, you know, patients were ringing us up and saying, my cough is so much better. I like to think it gave us a good run-up to work out how to best do the trials and what sort of things we should be measuring. And so we were ready when it came along.
Yes. And people are going to be wanting to know about the metrics, how we measure the cough in the clinic and in the trials. What's the best way, in your opinion, Jackie?
At this point, I have to say, obviously, I helped develop the Vitalojack cough monitor, so I'm perhaps not the most independent opinion here, but my view is, in clinical trials, to be able to objectively measure cough and show that your drug is making somebody cough less is an important thing. And I think it's particularly useful for proof of concept studies when you're trying to understand if that mechanism might be important. But in terms of patient benefit, you know, you need to also know that the amount of reduction you're getting with any particular cough treatment is enough that patients are going to feel better and benefit. So these patient-reported outcomes that we use are important as well. And the main ones that we use are a cough severity visual analog scale, which is just a simple 100-millimeter scale with people scoring the severity of their cough by making a line on it. And then there's the more involved quality of life questionnaires. So the Leicester cough questionnaire is probably the one that's been used the most and we understand the most about. So I think they're the ones that are the key for clinical trials. I think what we do in clinic is a bit different though. I mean, most of us do something that approaches a visual analog scale where we'll say to the patients, how bad is your cough? 0 to 10. And that's what I tend to do in my clinic.
Me too.
Quick and simple. The patients get the hang of it pretty quickly.
What do you do, Laurent?
Yeah, the same. Yeah, I agree. And the VAS score is very easy and very helpful for the evaluation of treatments and the response to treatment and LCQ score.
Okay, these new drugs, the P2X3 antagonists, their mechanism of action, I'm fascinated by. What appears to happen is that something damages the epithelium around the nerve endings, and then the epithelium releases alarmins. These are substances which produce a signal of damage or distress. And one of these is ATP. So ATP, which is normally the energy packets of the cell, are released out into the extracellular milieu. They come up against the nerve, and these P2X3 receptors on the nerve ending cause the channel to open, and the nerve depolarizes, and you get this tickle in the throat. So the P2X3 antagonists block the receptor, and they seem to be working in about 70 to 75% of people in the clinical trials. There are other drugs as well coming through. So there's blockers of substance P, neurokinin 1 receptor antagonists, which seem to work more centrally. And then, of course, we've got the opiates, which are much less used than I think should be, because they're only low-dose opiates. There's no point in taking a higher dose of morphine, and it's perhaps the drug that I use one amongst the most for people who have really failed all the other treatments. So in our ERS guidelines, and I think the guidelines have got it right in that we should try some simple treatments and then go to the neuromodulators, and we've only got the ones that we've got available, but now these new neuromodulators, which work peripherally, have really revolutionized our view. How do we think they're going to be used in the clinic?
Yeah, it's a tricky question because the inclusion criteria of the phase 3 trial of gefapixant was very wide. And the inclusion criteria were patients with chronic cough for 1 year or more and normal chest X-ray and no evidence of the diagnosis. So it's very wide. And we know that all those patients do not respond to the treatment. So we need biomarkers, and it's very important to know if the patient will respond to the treatment. And in the clinical practice, we need to check that there is no other diagnosis because we are talking about unexplained and refractory chronic cough. So the treatment is not for all the patients with chronic cough. And when we have identify patients with refractory chronic cough, unexplained chronic cough, yeah, I think it's a very good treatment. But this step of identifying refractory or unexplained chronic cough is very important.
There are some of the patients who have a sort of asthmatic-y type, eosinophilic phenotype as well. But how do you differentiate those from the majority who don't have this phenotype?
In our clinic, we don't have access to easily do sputum eosinophils. So we end up doing full blood count and pheno's where we can, although the trouble with pheno's is that patients have often been given inhaled corticosteroids already, which of course knocks it right down very effectively.
Well, what's your cutoff for the blood eosinophils?
For blood, in our clinic, 0.4 is abnormal, so above 0.3.
Exactly what I do. Laurent, do you have a cutoff for blood eosinophils to look for an asthmatic phenotype for this chronic cough?
0.3 for eosinophilic phenotype, and the normal value is under 0.5.
First time I think we've ever come to a consensus.
Surely not, Alan. We never disagree.
There's no doubt pollution, smoking, there's a whole range of things which can irritate the upper airway. And I think it becomes a vicious cycle.
I mean, it's quite possible, don't you think, Alan, that vicious coughing itself may add to ATP release in the airways as
Absolutely.
A mechanical thing. So in some patients, maybe you get this cycle of irritants make them cough, it releases more ATP, it stimulates the nerves more.
What about the central pathways? I mean, we're getting to know a lot more about that with the fMRI studies from Stuart Mazzoni. Jackie, do you think they are taking us in the right direction? Because I think they're showing different pathways for different types of cough.
As you say, the P2X3 antagonists are very helpful for our chronic cough patients. And as far as we know, those drugs don't penetrate the central nervous system. And so we think they're probably acting on ATP in the airways. But I guess we all probably wouldn't have thought that. And you know, you worry about peripheral mechanisms of action that they might be very specific. So whether drugs like gefapixant and the other P2X3 antagonists are going to be helpful in other conditions where coughing is a problem is as yet debatable. Whereas with central nervous system mechanisms, it may be that you've got certain common parts of the pathway that you can interrupt that might improve cough from a bunch of different conditions. And as you are alluding to, perhaps you can selectively disrupt some of the pathways that we believe are important in mediating irritant cough, as opposed to cough more stimulated by mechanical stimuli, which is protective and important.
Let's just talk about the downside, because these drugs do have side effects.
Well, my most memorable experience of this was when we first started the first proof of concept study with gefapixant. And the patients were ringing up. They were all ringing up very quickly saying, I can't taste a thing, but my cough has gone. Do I need to worry? And so we were reassuring them all that we were aware that loss of taste and disturbed taste was a side effect. It had been found in some of the healthy volunteer studies, but not quite so pervasively, shall we say. So all the patients in that first study at the 600 milligram dose complained of taste side effects. Although I have to say, many of them were happy to continue because they were getting such good benefit from their cough. Obviously, we're at much lower doses with gefapixant now, and all the work was done to show that you can not get rid of, but reduce the taste side effects to some degree and still get good antitussive effects at lower doses. And then the other question is whether these second generation P2X3 antagonists are going to reduce side effects in terms of taste earlier. And the proof of concept studies with those do seem to suggest that that's likely to be the case. They're more selective for P2X3 receptors over a receptor that's sort of a hybrid, a mixture of P2X3 and 2, so these 2-3 receptors that we think, based on rodent studies, are probably more important in taste and therefore mediating those side effects.
Laurent, there is a big geographical difference between various countries around the globe in terms of their enthusiasm for cough. The Italians are very enthusiastic for cough. What about France?
Yeah, to be honest, many respiratory physicians are pretty busy, and I understand that they prefer to focus on life-threatening diseases, lung cancer, COPD, and so on.
Well, we're hardly talking about typical times here, are we? Although cough is a presentation for COVID, it's not something that's been in long COVID at all. But in clinical practice, there must be a high incidence of patients presenting to cough to respiratory physicians in France. So what does the poor patient do? I know there's an ELF leaflet coming out very shortly on chronic cough, which matches up with the guidelines so that they are two documents that the patient can use together.
I think the new treatments will change the situation, because at the moment it's hard for the physicians to experience failure and not being able to explain the disease that we do not have treatment.
I'm sorry, Laurent, I disagree with you there. I think one of the most rewarding things that I do with a patient is I sit there and I'll say, you know, talk to them, they'll say, doctor, that's the first time anybody's asked me that question. It's a revelation to them that someone actually understands their condition, particularly the amount they suffer. There's one of my patients on YouTube. It's called The Cost of Cough. You'll be a hard person if you're not crying at the end of that video, because she really tells you the suffering from these poor patients.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the first step of the treatment is the explanation of the disease.
Absolutely.
And when we explain the disease, the patient feels better. But my co-workers in France are perhaps not aware of how explain the mechanism, the complex mechanism of chronic cough.
I mean, I remember a few years ago now, Jackie, you were at the British Thoracic Society on the podium, and someone in the audience was asking you a question, saying it was all in the patient's mind. And I was at the back of the hall, and I just couldn't believe I was hearing this.
We still hear this at times, don't we? And I think it's one of the things we're guilty of with doctors, when we can't explain things or we can't seem to improve things. Well, maybe it's just in people's heads, but I don't think any of us believe that.
To me, the patient's presentation is so characteristic that I can spot them, you know, going into a local shop, I'll spot a lady coughing and I'll say, I know what's wrong with you.
I tell you what though, Alan, it's a terrible time to have a chronic cough, isn't it? I've been really feeling for my patients of late, because when they go to the supermarket, they feel like everybody thinks they've got COVID and they're going to infect them.
Well, it's piled on the pressure to them. Because there's quite a few surveys now coming out showing that they have an increased incidence of depression. Urinary incontinence in ladies is a big hidden problem. In men, cough syncope is a major issue, I think. People are killed on the roads, and about 25 people a year are killed by fatal head-on collisions caused by cough syncope. And it occurs almost exclusively in middle-aged men who are overweight and often ex-smokers. But the great thing about the cough connect is every time there's something different coming along. You know, sometimes there's a neuropathy which is associated with it. Sometimes it's something wrong with the ear. So there is a great variety. And particularly now, we've got some new treatments coming along.
I think that's the most exciting thing, isn't it? The possibility of having some of the first licensed treatments will be great. And I think it will make it a lot easier for people to manage these patients.
If we do the diagnosis correctly, and these drugs are given, I can't see why they shouldn't be, provided they're priced right. And there's four of them in development, aren't there? So we will have drugs which are relatively cheap. And hopefully we will have a completely brand new therapy for airway disease. And I'll bet you this hypersensitivity doesn't just cause a cough. I think it causes some breathlessness as well. I think it's a hypersensitivity phenomenon of the vagus nerve again, but this time the person perceives breathlessness with cough. Laurent, we have this thing, chronic cough. Do you think it overlaps with other airway diseases, such as asthma and COPD? So can a patient have both?
I think so, yeah. For example, in COPD, we know that patients with COPD and chronic cough have more severe disease, and in severe asthma, the same. So probably there is a combination of two diseases. It's important to identify chronic cough in patients with asthma or COPD, because these diseases lead to an alteration of the quality of life. And it's important not to avoid avoid chronic cough, crucial for the patients.
Absolutely. And so with the new therapies, we might well be able to intervene in patients who are in the asthma clinic but have predominant chronic cough, and the same in the COPD clinic. If the patient is sitting there but coughing a lot, they may be like asthma COPD overlap syndrome. Like ACOS, they could be cough and COPD overlap syndrome. And I'm convinced there are. We've been doing some long-term cough recordings of patients with COPD, and there are a group of them who cough almost as much as people with chronic cough. Others cough a bit more than your average person, but this is the majority. But there is definitely a large minority who have chronic cough. So I'm convinced that this disease of chronic cough overlaps with other airways diseases. And it's a double problem because if the doctor doesn't recognize that there is this chronic cough, they keep on hitting them with more asthma treatment, and it doesn't seem to affect the cough very much because it's a different etiology. It's the hypersensitivity of the nerves rather than the inflammation within the airways.
Yeah, we were talking about biological therapies, and sometimes patients are given biological therapies for chronic cough and it doesn't work. So it's very, very important to identify that chronic cough is disease that needs a specific treatment.
Well, I've had some patients who have the eosinophilic phenotype of chronic cough. I mean, their main problem is cough. They're coughing away like nobody's business. That's the primary symptom. And they've got a very high blood eosinophil count as well, you know, 1, 1.5. In these patients, I've had some success with mepolizumab is the little study that we did. So if you pick that phenotype of chronic cough, the one with the eosinophilic bronchitis, I think, is rather than genuine asthma, then you can have some effect of biological therapy. But this is a very small minority and targeted.
Yeah, but are you talking about patients with isolated chronic cough? And it's the only symptom of the patients?
Yeah, so these guys have eosinophilic bronchitis without wheezing. So you've got classic asthma where you get wheezing and bronchial hyperresponsiveness. Then you're supposed to have cough variant asthma where there is just bronchial hyperresponsiveness and not much peak flow variability or reversibility. And then there is eosinophilic bronchitis where you're not supposed to have much airway narrowing at all. So there is no peak flow variability and no bronchial hyperresponsiveness, i.e. twitchy muscles as opposed to twitchy nerves. So that was the traditional classification of it. I think blurs into each other. People in splitters and lumpers, and I'm afraid I'm a lumper, I put things together. And people are individuals within that spectrum that you see. And it's our job to pick that individual spectrum. Going back to the drugs, Jackie,
mm-hmm.
There are four different ones coming through, and you've already said that there are some characteristics which are different, particularly as the side effect profile. Do you think they're going to differ in efficacy as well?
It's hard to tell at the moment. The phase two studies have all been quite small, so you know you get big confidence intervals around the effect sizes. I mean, the other thing that makes it challenging is we're seeing more and more placebo effects in these studies, which I personally think is to do with, at least to some degree, with the patients getting quite excited about the possibility of drugs that work, so we can raise their expectations. And so it makes it difficult to say. Obviously, we saw that huge effect in that very first proof of concept study, gefapixant, at 75% reduction over placebo. We haven't seen such big effects in the phase twos of the follow-on drugs, but I just think it's hard to compare at this stage. I think once we get some more large-scale studies, it's going to be easier to understand that. But it's slightly the multi-million dollar question is whether if you dial out that taste effect, do you lose some of the efficacy or not?
I mean, there are cough deniers, aren't there, who will be entirely resistant to the idea that patients actually have this syndrome, I think. And they stick with their diagnosis of asthma despite all of the evidence. It's a very difficult problem. I think the placebo response is one of the things that they criticize. They say, in our trials, we get a large placebo response. Okay. Mm. Yeah, we do. Okay. But if you look at migraine, for example, which is everybody agrees is a legitimate disease, and there is a big placebo effect in all of the migraine studies.
Yeah, I mean, and in other sorts of pain as well, Alan, it's really well described. And, you know, with any symptom, to appreciate the symptom, it's got to go through the central nervous system. So it's to some degree not surprising that placebo effects can be quite significant here. I think we do need to try and think of better ways of mitigating those placebo effects if we can, because I do worry it's going to impede our ability to see more subtle treatment effects if we can reduce cough by 50% with a placebo.
Yeah, but if the drug is reasonably priced, next year we may be able to give a medicine which gets 70% of people with this syndrome of chronic cough better.
Which would be great, wouldn't it? And most exciting of all for the patients.
They are desperate.
Indeed.
We have tears quite frequently, and it's not just me.
And the number of emails is going up. People are, I think, seeing stuff, Googling about the new drugs coming, and I'm getting more and more emails every week asking about them.
Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast. And thank you, Professors Jackie Smith and Laurent Guillemont, for their contributions and insights on the topic. We hope this discussion was as interesting to listen to as it was to take part in. We had a lot of fun. Note that two new podcasts will be released on the ERS Respiratory Channel each month, featuring discussions from experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.